up for any of the ALAs, which has done, and talking to the board, finish my doctorate, they decided they will come back again to teach the it's a big honor to acknowledge the President of Bacon and Professor Krakauer, and to thank Rabbi Elstab for the introduction. The subject that we have to talk about today is a very difficult one, a very tragic one, and a very sad one. It goes to the heart of what was so much of the medieval Jewish historical experience, the ancient Jewish historical experience, and of course the modern Jewish historical experience. Just 2 days ago, 3 days ago, on Sunday was the Yom HaShoah, and gives us another opportunity to focus perhaps in greater detail on what happened during the Second World War, and of course, struggle to come to terms with the implications of what was happening. What I'd like to do for a little while is to work out with you a certain methodology that I think is critical in order to help us understand the whole issue of Yom HaShoah, and to place the debate within our community today as to whether or not there should be a Yom HaShoah into some kind of a historical perspective. I'm sure to some extent you're aware of the fact that within the Orthodox Jewish community, there are some people who are in favor of a Yom HaShoah, and there are some people who are not in favor of a Yom HaShoah. Those who are not in favor are no less sensitive and concerned and overwhelmed by the implications of the Shoah. Not at all, but yet they feel that the way to express that feeling is not done best through the medium of a special day to commemorate that event, but rather feel that it should be subsumed under the classic day that set aside to commemorate Jewish tragedy, and that is, of course, on Tisha. So what I would like to do is talk about the issue of subsuming and the issue of uniqueness, and to trace this in pre-modern times in order to put the modern issue into a historical perspective. I'd like to start by kind of front-loading my conclusion and telling you exactly what I believe is the truth in this case, the method that I believe is really operative when it comes to dealing with this issue, and then to step back a little bit and to try to tease it out through some of the sources that I put here on the sheet that I contributed for. Now, I've been very careful with formulating this, so I'm going to read just a couple of lines, because every word here is really carefully chosen, and because there's so much riding on this, I want to make sure that the formulation is absolutely precise. This is, after many years of thinking about this is essentially what I believe to be what characterizes Jewish response to catastrophe, which unfortunately is something that we've experienced so much, from the beginning until perhaps even until the Holocaust. And their effort to maintain faith in God, and she, where is the extra sheet? Okay. In their effort to maintain faith in God in the face of often incredible suffering, and you understand that often incredible suffering, the underlying often, because unfortunately this is a reality that was very much part of the Jewish experience. In their effort, in the effort on the part of Jews to maintain their faith in God in spite of the fact that they suffered so much, Jewish victims of tragedy in all centuries, bar none, in all centuries, felt constrained to view their experiences as part of a continuum and not as something radically new and different. This is standard procedure. When one comes across a catastrophe, a tragedy, a communal pogrom, God forbid, in the 14th century, the 15th century, the 16th century, the 17th century, in Spain, in Germany, in Poland, in Turkey, no matter when it happened and no matter where it happened, the general reaction is to say, what happened to us is not something new. What happened to us is part of a line of events that happens to our ancestors and to their ancestors and to their ancestors and to our co-religionists in different parts of the world. They did not see that which happened to them as being something unique and something different. Although they may have objectively believed that the magnitude of their suffering was unprecedented, in other words, although they may have felt upon mature reflection that nobody, in fact, really ever experienced the kind of tragedy that they experienced, that the level and the intensity and the impact of their own tragedy was greater than any other. They never presented it as such, for fear that this might indicate that God was breaking his covenantal bond with the Jewish people. This is a critical point. What does this mean? And if, in fact, they saw this event as something that had no precedent, and it was totally different, and something that never happened before, that would mean, perhaps, and this is the danger, that maybe God is acting to the Jewish people now in a way that God didn't act before. Until now, we understand the basic system. The basic classical system is we sin, and God responds to our sin by punishing us. This is a classical, general, overall theological system. Now, what happens if you suffer a terrible tragedy? We're talking now on a communal level. If the community suffers a tragedy, what the community did throughout history was to say, oh my God, we must have done something really bad in order to deserve it. What did we do? And they went ahead and tried to discover various sins that they must have committed to justify this kind of a reaction. We find it in the Gemara repeatedly after the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash. What was this sin? No nachbar in Yerushalayim elo bishvil zeh. No nachbar in Yerushalayim elo bishvil that. But the whole other Gemara, Masechta Shabbat, that gives 7, 8, 9, 10 different reasons. Lo nachbar Yerushalayim elo. And the purpose of that is not in order to knock themselves. On the contrary, the purpose is in order to build up the levels of sin to be so great that they could justify what happened to them, and therefore the paradigm, the big box into which all of this fits, namely, we sin, God punishes, that paradigm remains intact. Okay, does anybody not follow what I'm saying? Because this is a crucial point. There's a certain deal here. There's a certain way the game is played. There's a certain kind of a relationship between the Jewish people and God. We made a certain way, God made a certain way. Every event that happened throughout history, there was an attempt to place that event into that framework, so that the basic framework, the essence of the framework, remains intact. There's a danger, however, if one perceives of one tragedy unlike any other previous tragedy, that means that perhaps it is now pushing itself out of the box or off the line or continuum of tragedy. Then the danger is, well, maybe the whole relationship is off. Maybe God is acting to us in a way he never acted before. We didn't deserve it. But on the flood, maybe this calls into question the whole relationship between the Jewish people and God, between God and the Jewish people. And today we understand very well why it's critically important for Jews throughout the ages, and they did this repeatedly again in every century and in every country, to try to argue that what happened to them was not unprecedented. That it somehow still, as horrible as it was, it still fits into the basic paradigmatic model of we do something and God reacts accordingly. Whatever cataclysmic event Jews experienced was never seen in isolation as something sui generis, which means that a class all by itself, but rather it was portrayed as the latest example of the age-old, consistently recurring phenomenon of God's punishment for Jewish sin. Indeed, the Jewish collective memory was so sharp and was so long that any time it confronted even a tragedy of major proportions, it was able to place it into a paradigm of some previously occurring tragedy. In fact, you understand also very well that the greater the tragedy, the greater the tragedy objectively, the greater the danger that this would cause to somebody's faith. Because the greater the possibility that it would push out of that box, that it wouldn't fit into the paradigm. And therefore, the greater effort was made to in fact keep it within the so-called box. To assign a precedent even for that which objectively had no precedent. Even though objectively they understood, historically they understood, rationally they understood that it was unprecedented, nobody ever suffered the way they suffered. Nowhere was ever so many Jews killed as were killed in this particular place. But they couldn't leave it at that, because the danger was that what would this do in terms of our relationship with God? So the greater the tragedy, the greater the danger, the greater the effort made to push it right back into the box, and to somehow define a precedent even for the unprecedented. Now you understand very well where the Holocaust comes into play. This issue of continuities, paradigms, or another word I would use is an archetype, a sort of archetypal relationship between God and the Jewish people, that God Israel, connected to Israel, continue to try to struggle to maintain so that we still have a closeness to God. This issue is tested severely when it came to the Shoah, when it came to the Holocaust. For some, and we will see this at the end of the presentation, the Holocaust itself was also another tragedy to be plotted along the continuum of other tragedies. We had the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash, we had a crusade in the 12th century, we had the Khmelnytsky massacres in Poland in the 17th century, and we'll talk about both of those in a minute. We had the Kishinev pogroms in Russia at the beginning of the 20th century, and we have the Holocaust in the middle of the 20th century. As horrible as it was, they too tried to keep it within the box, to keep it within the line. It's one more along the line of Jewish tragedy. However, for others, that could not be. Maybe until now, one could possibly try to squeeze whatever happened into the box. But when it came to the Shoah, it was impossible. It was so horrible, and so awful, and so unspeakable, and so unprecedented, that stand on your head and squeeze however you want, it is impossible to try to place it within that paradigm, and therefore alternate methods of approach have to be discussed. The standard theology totally crumbled, and new avenues have to be explored. This, in a nutshell, is the issue about Yom HaShoah. Whether to have Yom HaShoah on Yom HaShoah, on Chav Zayin Nisan, or whether to have Yom HaShoah on Tisha B'Av, revolves around this essential question. Namely, is the Shoah consumable, or is the Shoah insubsumable? Is it possible to see the Shoah as part of the continuum, in which case it belongs very well during Tisha B'Av? Because Tisha B'Av, you understand, is not a day that we only mourn for the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. We look at the keynotes that we recite on Tisha B'Av, we talk about events that happened other times. We talk about the crusades that happened in the month of April and in the month of May, things that happened in the month of Av. It's nothing to do with the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. But Tisha B'Av is a time that is set aside to commemorate tragedy. So we should commemorate the Shoah as well. That's the date for that. That's the date that's set aside to commemorate tragedy, and this is another tragedy. However, if you say that the Shoah can be subsumed, that it somehow burst out of this neat little package that everybody for centuries and for millennia tried to push all the Torahs into, then you say the Shoah can't be commemorated on Tisha B'Av. On the contrary, it's sacrilege. How can you say it's just one more? It's so different, it's so unusual, it's so unprecedented that it's machayit. It requires its own separate thing. What I want to do, based on the material that I prepared for you, is to show you how this essentially plays itself out within the context of one other specific day in the Jewish calendar, which today is virtually unknown and unacknowledged and unrecognized, and use that as an example of the larger issue that I want to deal with. Our story begins on a spring day in south central France, in the city of Blois, B-L-O-I-S, the first entry on the first page of the DFM sheet. There's an extra sheet somewhere in the back. Are there extra sheets? Sorry. The city of Blois, which today is in France, has a river that goes through it. The Loire River, L-O-I-R-E, river, courses through the city of Loire. One day in the spring of 1171, there was a chance meeting on the Luan River between a Jew by the name of Yitzchak and a Christian servant. The Jew by the name of Yitzchak was carrying skins that he had recently procured from one of the burghers who was living in the town of Lot, B-U-R-G-H-E-R-S. The skin slipped from his hand and frightened the horse that the Christian servant was riding on, and threw the Christian servant off the horse. He was so unnerved and upset that he immediately went running to his master and told his master as follows: 5 minutes ago, on the banks of the Loire River, I saw a Jew disposing of the body of a Christian child, of a dead Christian baby. This had a name in medieval Jewish history. Anybody know what it's called? What?
Libel.
The blood libel and the ritual murder accusation. What does that mean? Christians accused Jews throughout the Middle Ages of killing Christian babies, specifically around generally Pesach time, and using the blood to serve ritual purposes. This was the accusation that was leveled against Christians. Now, this is not the first ritual murder accusation or mud libel accusation in Europe. There were two beforehand. They were both in England. But there was a big difference. The big difference was that the two of England, each one of them had a dead Christian child that was produced. Each one of them could point to a dead Christian child. In Norwich, there was William. In Gloucester, there was Harold, a little baby Nebuch that somebody obviously killed and planted in the Jewish house in order to get the Jews in trouble, but there was a body. In Blois, 1171, there was no body that was even ever discovered. In the third ritual murder accusation. Nevertheless, for whatever reason, and this is beyond our discussion, this was taken very seriously in the court of Blois. 40 Jews were living in the community. They were given a choice to either convert or to be killed, and ultimately 33 were burned to the stake. 33 Jews were burned to the stake on May 26, 1171. May 26, 1171 corresponds in the Hebrew calendar to Chas Sivan, to the 20th day of Sivan. So on the 20th day of Sivan, in the year 1171, 33 Jews are burned to the stake in Blois as a result of this, obviously false, blood libel ritual murder accusation. As a result of this event, Rabbeinu Tam instituted a knife, a fast. If you take a look on the top right-hand corner, the biblical text that we have, the most famous really text that we have in Hebrew about this event, is printed in the Sefer Tzeirot, Ashkenaz, certified by Alexander Haberman. Tells you the story, and he says that it's appropriate. 3 lines from the bottom, top right hand corner, the Ra'ui Hu L'Kod L'Son L'Chol B'nei Amesh. Such a horrible thing that happened. 33 Jews were killed. It's appropriate that he should establish it. And in fact, it was. Top left hand corner has English in the middle. Rabbi the Shabbat entered the Kidman Dalam Allah in Tuf Kufman Dalas. Yes, English Wednesday, the 20th of Sivan of 1171, was affected by all the communities living here. Sarfa, Iyayan, Zerayim, all the communities, France, England, and Germany, at the day of mourning and fasting of their own will, and at the behest of the mitzvah, and of all the great Rabbeinu Tam. The great Rabbeinu Tam, the grandson of Rashi, the famous Bali Atosos, Rabbeinu Tam was mitzvahing, established the decree of fast day for huge numbers of Jews in order to commemorate Lador and Noras for all generations. The horror of horrors that happened in Blois when 33 Jews were burned. So skipping 500 years to the 17th century. Nachamo, again, Jewish tragedy. I mentioned his name before. A fellow by the name of Bogdan Khmelnytsky, the sign, C-H, I'm not going to write it on the board, M-I-B-L-N-I-C-K-I. Bogdan Khmelnytsky decides that he, on behalf of the Ukrainian peasants, wants to gain independence from the Polish overlord. The Jews, for all kinds of reasons, were the middlemen at that time, were fronting
were the Polish overlords.
And they were the ones who represented the overlords in their dealings with the general populace. As a result, the Jewish community was stuck right in the middle, and many hundreds of Jewish communities were destroyed, and thousands of Jews were killed. And we're talking now in the year 1648 and the year 1649. It started in the city of Nemirov. If you look in the middle on the right-hand corner of the first page, you see Zera Shelkin.
It was Joseph Nemirov.
This is taken from the most famous historical source that we have, namely the Sefer Yevamim Lesura, or the Nasa Hanover, the most famous historical source that we have about what happened during 1648-1649. It started in the city of Nemirov. And on what day did it start in the city of Nemirov? We launched from the bottom. Naivi on Dalar on Wednesday. Chach. Yivan on the 20th of Sivan Bohovak Kozakin. Tabok near Nemirov. And the slaughter began. Lasted for about a year and a half. And after it was finished around 1660, the rabbis who were living at that time figured they wanted to do something to commemorate this terrible tragedy. What do? You have a problem. Jews are being killed every day for a year and a half, so which day are you going to choose to be the day to commemorate that tragedy? They decided they would choose the day it began. When did it begin? On the 20th of Tiff, and therefore left hand. Okay. The Asu Lohan, left hand to the left of that in the middle. Page 1, the Asu Lohan, the already have the English at the bottom. What do? They establish a fast day on what day? Lo and behold, on the 20th of December. Which means, obviously, that the fast day that was established for the remaining time was not being carried out all the way down until the time had it been carried out, they were already due day. It was on the books, but they weren't fast. They establish it on the 20th of Siv on this time to commemorate the tragedy that happened to them in the 17th century. However, they remembered Rabbi Yochanan's family. If you look at the bottom, Shach. Shach is a very, very famous great and evil rabbinic scholar whose commentary graces the pages of the Shulchan Aruch and to tremendous rabbinic authority, who himself lived through the events of Cholin, wrote a little pamphlet describing what happened on the Divat Kitzvah, and he tells us at the bottom of page 1 that he himself was the one who instituted the fast day. And why did he pick the 20th of Sivan? He gives three reasons. Reason number 1, because that's when it began. Reason number 2, he says, the guy on the third line in the middle, because on this day the afflictions were doubled. He got to say Rak 1171 I tap a Yomahu Bokana's money. Because 1171 was also on that day. So what is he doing? He's taking a day that was set aside already in 1171 for a fast day. They're not fasting on that day anymore, but it's kind of misugal. Kind of set aside for fasting. We're going to resurrect that day as a fast day and take care of two things. We'll take care of the fast day for our own time, and we'll take care of the fast day for the tragedy that happened 500 years earlier, almost, in 1171. Top of page 2. One of the other great scholars who lived through the time was someone whose commentary graces the pages of the standard edition of the Mishnah, namely Rabbi Yonkov Lichtman Heller, the Tosfos Yonkov. Tosfos Yonkov lived through, just like the Shach did, the Tosfos Yonkov lived through the Chmelnitsky massacre. He was approached to write a Kina, to write a Sicha, to describe what happened during this time, to incorporate some kind of a liturgical expression into the document. And he turned people down. He said, I don't want to do it. So they sent him, but he just wrote one for a terrible tragedy that happened in Prague a little while ago. So why don't you write one for what happened to us? What happened to us is even greater than the tragedy that happened in Prague. So if you wrote one for Prague, why don't you write one for us? So the answer is something very important. It's very basic principle. You have the English on the left, the original on the left. He says that, when do I write for Prague? I write for Prague because Prague was a different kind of attraction. Because Prague was not your standard on the line, to use my terminology, trash. In Prague, he says, Jews got stuck in the middle. They didn't really want to get the Jews. They wanted to get their enemies. But the Jews never got stuck. The Jews got stuck, so they got punished. But that's not what happened here, he says. What happened here is they were out to get the Jews. That's failure. It doesn't matter the numbers. It matters the method. If Jews are the victims, then that gets into the paradigm, into the box, into the standard line. And that's a standard tragedy like every other tragedy. See, if any more Jews were killed, come tell you, you're right. But it doesn't matter. Jews are the intended victims now like they were always were. And therefore, he said, I don't have to write a keynote for what happened now. I'll simply take a keynote for an event that happened another time, a previous time. I'll dust off a keynote that was written for the Crusade, and I'll use it now. Because they were greater than I am anyway. They wrote much fancier Hebrew and much more sublime and in-depth stuff than I could write. So I don't have to write a new one. Since it's the same kind of a tragedy, I'll take an old one and I'll use it today. You'll tell me I wrote for Prague. Prague is not the same kind of a tragedy. Prague is a different kind of a tragedy. It's off the line, then it requires its own commemoration. It requires its own care. This is the principle, the yesod, people call it, the basic principle established by the post-discussion. We'll come back to it right before we conclude. Remember, what's the principle? If it's on the line, then it just fits in to the psychology. If it's off the line, it's different, it's unusual, then it goes off and has to be treated in a separate way. This fast day of the 20th of Sivan, although it fell into disrepair between the 12th and the 17th century, continued to remain in force from the 17th century until the 20th century. And we have examples. Yes? We have a good question, but there was no France, England, and Germany by the 13th, 14th, and 15th century. France, England, and Germany picked itself up and moved into Poland. So in other words, the Ashkenazi community, we have no resonance of what happened to the remaining times affair. We have a lot of resonance about other Gezeros and Takonos of Rabbeinu Tam in Poland that were carried over by the Ashkenazi community as they were moving eastward. But this itself, I'm in the middle of trying to trace by city and by Rishon, echoes of this. The Tiaz. And I haven't found any reference to this in any of the literature in the 30th, 40th, and 50th century. So it would appear that although Rabbeinu Tam didn't come going as a tremendous army, for whatever reason, and I don't know what the reason is, it didn't happen. It didn't catch up. When the Shah and the Gaone Arbar themselves instituted brackets re and brackets instituted it in the 17th century, it stuck like glue. And you have references to it in all the centuries that were inhabited by Ashkenazi Jews. And I just give you a few examples here, and you can look at it on your own if you're interested in. The one that's most significant is the one from the Taz, which is in the middle of the page, standing by itself on the right-hand side, where the Taz says, Venera Li, Tanit, Shegonzru, Manhige, Shalosha, Rotsot, Tiruf, Ga'onim, with the Tanot, the Kol, Kof, Simon, etc. This is a very important fact that was established on the 20th of Sivan, and it should be performed on a Monday and a Thursday, when we have normally a separate Torah reading, on a Monday and Thursday for the Shacharis to read the Torah portion that we're going to read that coming Shabbat. But if 20th of Sivan falls on a Monday and Thursday, we read the Torah portion that we read on a fast day. We read the section called the Vayichal. We read a separate section for a Titus. That takes precedent over the money and how important it is. And then there is evidence for the continued following of this metric into the 20th century. One small example is in the bottom right hand corner, which I just fell upon when I was doing research on something else. This is from the Encyclopedia Judaica, telling us about a fast day that was established in 1906, in the fall of 1906, in Bialystok, as a result of the terrible massacres that took place at the first beginning of the 20th century, as a result of the October Revolution. In October 1905, there was a revolution in the former Soviet Union. As a result, many Jewish communities were destroyed. The most famous one is the Kishinev pogrom that took place that time in the wake of the October Revolution. And this particular case, the community of Bialystok, in the fall of 1906, established a campaign. If you look at the underlying section, it's all in Yiddish. I'll read it to you. You should all know, you should all come to shul. Terrible thing. At Martin, Monday, Bar Kislev, tomorrow, Monday, the 6th of Kislev. Kislev is in October. So, Zion HaKainet Tzibur, we're going to have a fast day. But Alabak in the Russian, that the Zab of Slichot Shel Chavkin. They're going to say the Slichot of Chavkin on Bar Kislev. What does Chavkin have to do with Bar Kislev? The answer is everything in the world. Because Chav Sivan became a day, if the old house is empty. Right? Why make a new one now? It's all in the line of tragedy. So Yankov didn't want to make one for Chav Sivan. He said we'll use from the Crusades. Other people did make for Chav Sivan. Now in Bialystok, they're saying we don't need one for Bialystok. We'll use one from 1648. So everybody's piggybacking on everybody else. Because it's all the same line. Once it's the same line, it's consumable. You remember how I started? And once it's consumable, then you have to make your own. Because you just have to do somebody else's. And they were like greater than we were anyway. So who am I to compare to what they could write? They could write a lot better than I can. So I use one of theirs and not one of mine. Which brings us to the Shabbat. Which brings us to the last page. I'm going to ask you to turn to the last page. If you're ever bored and you're ever depressed, and you're ever sad, this will do the trick. I don't know if the third time library has it. Go find the transcript of the debate in the Knesset. If you ever been to the Knesset, you will know. You have to be there 5 minutes, and in defense of the confession, I'm sure she within 5 minutes, somebody's going to get off the stage. The cursing and the back and the forth is unbelievable. And there's somebody sitting there writing on every kamar, every pitch, every bow, every dog, every shikak, and it's too loud. People are screaming and yelling, cussing each other out without any question, and everybody's trying to outshout the other one. And it's all being transcribed, it's all being taped, and it's all written down. Every word of it is condemned. That's why the Divrei Knesset is about 5 miles long. The state of Israel is only 60 years old. Because what happens is on the typical page, you open it up and have the maker of the person come there and send somebody, the parenthesis, which party they're from, and parenthesis. Come on. Faith. Next one. The name and the affiliation. The page, the Shugah, back and forth. They're all screaming each other's all in there. But there are other important things that are also in the Divrei Knesset. And that is what I here ask you for. How does the state of Israel deal with what happened during the Holocaust? This is a huge question. It's the subject of a book that Manish just came out in English translation by Tom Seged. That's the second half of his book. The first half of the book is how the state of Israel didn't let, how the, not the word mistake, and how he claims the leaders of the Yeshuv in Israel did nothing to try to help the Jews during the Second World War. We're familiar with David Wyman's book about the United States, the abandonment of the Jews, and we're familiar with Rothstein's book about England. And now we have Seger's book, who damned the leaders of the Yeshua for the same thing, but they were not interested in what was going on, and Palestine was going on, and helping Jews in Europe. That's the first half of the book, and he argues it very strongly. I'm not saying that it's not the same as well. Let me ask you a question. How does the state of Israel, which is really dealing with what happened last month? When you understand it, it'll keep calm. The problem is, the state of Israel, strong, macho, cabra, kibbutznik, he's got his shirt unbuttoned all the way down to his belly button, and his shirt is open on, he's got hairy chest, he's got a big medallion hanging in a big macho, he's got an army, he's got an air force, he's going to fight, and he's going to show the world that he's also tough and he's also strong. And then Nebuch has to deal with the fact, Nebuch, that Jews, the way they understood it, they were so passive and they didn't fight back and they were so weak. And the all of these horrible issues that we struggle with when it comes to the Shoah was so offensive, particularly to the person who's trying to project the Jew as being Mr. Russia. So how did the same issue deal with it? The answer is they dealt with it very poorly. In the first few years of the existence of the state of Israel, they couldn't deal with the Shoah at all. But this has been documented elsewhere. 1951, 3 years after the founding of the state of Israel, they decide maybe we should do something formally to commemorate the Shoah. So what do you do when you have an idea? You appoint a committee. So they appointed a committee. The committee was headed by Rabbi Nurak, who was a member of Amdal, the Mizrahi party. Rabbi Nurak meets with his committee, comes to the Knesset to report. And I invite you to have eavesdrop as Rabbi Nurak is reporting to the Knesset on April 12, 1961, the first reference in the Divrei Knesset to a projected Yom HaShoah. And he says, you know, we really need something. We really must have something. Look at how he formulates. Avotenu tiknu lano ra'ut shonim, we're now on the very last page, right? Avotenu tiknu lano ra'ut shonim yom tov ve'evel. After all, we have a precedent for this now, that's a day for tragedy. Kamo, what's the precedent? Our old friend now. Kamo chas tisimah. Now you understand what the precedent is. The old, she'im ha'ashvotam b'shum panim el ha'tragedia ha'kabir ha'shel yameh. They can do something, Chav Sivan, the 33 Jews who Nebuch were killed in Gua, or for 100,000 Jews who were killed during the Chmelnytsky massacre, then there's no comparison to what we suffered, the tragedy during our own time. And if they deserve their own day, then we certainly deserve our own day. So when should it be? In other words, what's he arguing here? He's arguing that it's not consumable. It's not on Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av didn't want to do it for the Shoah, just like Tisha B'Av didn't do it for 1648 and for 1171. And if it didn't do it for that, then it certainly can't do it for us. So we need our own day. So when should it be? Jews were killed for 6 years every single day. Which day should we pick? And this is hard to tie. This was a specific day. Hamatim gan l'zman roga shitot shal ya'adu l'roga. What they should be Jews? Well, one criteria is to choose at least a time of year when, if you have to sit back and look at the statistics, most of the Jews were killed. Most of the Jews were killed in the springtime. 1940, 1941, 1942, 1943, 1944, 1945, the time of year of all the other times of year when Jews were killed long within the springtime. So let's do it in the spring. Second consideration. Ulemered Hadikaot. We fought back. We were tough. Look at the name on the top. The very top of the page. Hachlapavizar Kibiyat Yom HaShoah Ulemered Hadikaot. There was no way that the state of Israel could even consider a Yom HaShoah unless it was coupled at the very beginning with "We were tough also. We fought back also." That's the only way they can live with it. And you understand why it was so, because it was so contrary. The Bible, the theology, was contrary to the image that we're trying to project to the world, and therefore they needed that Mary Hadisa over at the beginning. So even what Rav Nurak says, we have to go at a time. When they fought back, when did they fight back? Well, we all know, 50 years ago on Sunday. 50 years. Anniversary of the Wolfgang Uprising, but it's not true. When was the Wolfgang Uprising? The Wolfgang Uprising was on the second day of Pesach. So in the minutes of the subcommittee, the secularists are saying, you know how we should have Yom HaShoah? On the second day of Pesach. Because that was the time when we fought back. That's the only way to commemorate the Shoah. So the religious says, what are you doing? On Pesach? On a Yom Kippur? You're going to have a Yom HaShoah? You're out of your mind? Can't have it. So they had this whole debate. We'll have it after Yom. But we can't have it too much after Yom, because then you run into Yom HaAtzmaot. You can't have it too much before, because you run into Yom. Before Yom, Tatshenish. Too far before the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. So if Yavarin came out, Chav Zayin Nissan. That's how Chav Zayin Nissan came. The compromise between people who wanted it on the
fixing for Nisan, and people wanted it way later on. So it came out during the month of Nisan. And it worked very well for the Zionist ideology. Because you have 1 week. 1 week is in Yom HaShoah, the next week is Yom HaHatzmaut. And this encapsulates in a microcosm the Zionist view of the world, of modern Jewish history, to be oversimplistic. Namely, from the depths of the depths to the heights of the heights. And in 1 week we move collectively. Our spirits soar from Mamish, the bottom of the bottom. We reach the denouement of modern Jewish history, the founding of the State of Israel. So what happened is, it fits neatly to that. Well, what's the issue? What does Rabbi Urach say here? And why do I call this to you? First of all, the precedent is, for a new, unsubsumable date. But once I'm already figuring out when should the day be, he says there's a third consideration. We should have it during the time of year when the Jews were killed by the Crusades. When were the Jews killed by the Crusades? Mostly, the first Crusade is the Jewish communities of Shom, Shire, Ramayz, and Magetha, Fire, Worms, and Mice, were killed as the Kinos tell us explicitly that we recite on Tisha B'Av in the month of Nisan, in Iyar, and in Sivan, which is April and May. April and May. So, when it comes to a new day, this is the methodology, it's fascinating. It's not consumable. Whether we should have a new day or not, we need a new day. They had one for Chassidim, we need one too. But now that I'm figuring out when the day should be, now I'll try to consume it. I'll try to link it to a previous tragedy, to the tragedy of the system. 7 years later, 1958, pops up the issue once again in the Knesset. And Rabbi Nura gets up and he makes a long speech and he says, 7 years ago I stood here. And 7 years ago I said that we should have a day. But nothing has happened. Without Romanu in the single paragraph at the bottom, Ein anu ro'in ki ha'am ha'yashay v'tziyon v'gam v'dinat Yisrael ma'yishin u'mifaynim v'ofan yuchad et chashivuto v'dishato shal yom v'tikon v'tikon nothing's happening. We don't see anybody doing anything. But they shashu if tuchim v'yom v'lir v'acha the movie house, it's a rope, the restaurant's rope, well let's go to Hazar Shitan, everybody's having a great time, nothing's happening. You see how hard it was for them to deal with this? 7 years later, nobody budged on this. It was only, I believe, till 1961, when the day was in fact established, the day that we know very well, the 27th of Nisan, when at 11 o'clock the siren is sound, everybody gets out of their car, 2 minutes of silence, 1961. And what's it called? Yom HaShoah Tehagevurah! That's really significant. It's not a coincidence. You're winning. What do you mean passive? What do you mean by sheep to the floor? We fought, we punched, we shot, we threw a Molotov cocktail. That's the way it coupled in order to make it palatable for so much of Israeli society. Which brings me to my last two references in the morning. And that is one from the Chazamish and one from the Rosh Hashanah. Should there be a Yom HaShoah or should there not be a Yom HaShoah? So this is about to take a whole session, but I just want to bring to your attention, if you're motivated, you can go ahead and look it up further on your own. Chazal says absolutely not. You can't have a Yom HaShoah. You can't have a special fast day. The issue that he was dealing with was really a twofold issue. Not a Yom HaShoah the way we understand it. Number one, to the past, should the Jews of the world sit shiva after the Second World War to what happened? Should it be 1 week that's set aside by everybody that Klal Yisrael should be no hay shiva yimei aveilah? Should be aveilah to sit on the floor and take their clothes and then wear sneakers? Should sit shiva for a whole week? So he said no. Second question, what about fast day? What about fast day? It says, bottom left hand corner on page 2, Kain Kriyata Nisuza Rosh, Hildech Lam Mitzvah de Rabbanah. In order to establish a fast day, you know, we guys, we can't do this. This is heavy stuff. this is something that the mitzvah and the rabbanon have a fast day. And those fast days that we do have, they come from times when there was still prophecy. The Echmanis Panelu, and how dare we practice Dor Shatovlo Hashika, a generation for which silence is most appropriate, by our hair, Katoza, 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 who are we to go ahead and establish something for all generations if only someone who is living during the time of prophecy, a dying in the wild, they can establish it like that. Because we can't understand it. Question. What's wrong with the Chazonish? What's the problem with the Chazonish? What happened to Chassidim? Chassidim was established in the 17th century. Okay, it was established. In the 12th century, there was no problem. As a result of that, on the top of page 2, a rabbi sits in Newark, New Jersey, wrote an article, and he said, no more, no less, that this passage of the Chazonish is a forgery. Was it written? How can you written it? What happened? The Chassidim. Ergo, he didn't write it. Somebody else wrote it. He looked at it. It's printed in the Codex Hebrew Chazonish, which was published and sent to the Chazonish. Who knows who tampered with the manuscript? Somebody slipped it in. It's impossible that the Chazonish